From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ed Morin with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, April 22, 2020. The number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Maine climbs to 907. The State Center for Disease Control is reporting outbreaks, which consist of at least three cases, at each of two more congregate care settings. One outbreak is at the Edgewood Rehabilitation and Living Center in Farmington, where two cases are confirmed in residents and one among staff. State CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah says the other outbreak is at a facility that serves people with developmental disabilities.
We are also aware of three cases of COVID-19 associated with the John Murphy Homes in Auburn, one among residents and two among staff.
The CDC says two more people have died at the Tall Pines Assisted Living Facility in Belfast for a total of 10 resident deaths. As increased testing for COVID-19 continues to be the focus for state health officials and governors, Maine CDC Director Shah says the goal is to make sure state and commercial labs can process results quickly.
Our goal is to make it such that each and every healthcare provider in Maine can offer a test to any of his or her patients without fear that the test might get rejected by a commercial laboratory or any laboratory because of resource constraints.
He says a shortage of those supplies has kept Maine from beefing up its testing capacity, but that Maine's rate of testing is in the top quarter of the country. House members return to Washington this week to vote on the economic stimulus bill that was just passed in the U.S. Senate. Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree thinks the House will follow suit, unlike the Senate that passed the measure by unanimous consent. Pingree says House members are traveling back to the Capitol to cast their votes. She expects there will be opposition to the measure, but not enough to defeat the bill. And the weather. Tonight, clearing for all but the far north and mountains. Winds will ease. Lows in the teens for most, 20 to 25 near and along the coast. Tomorrow, partly cloudy in the north, mostly sunny elsewhere. Breezy across the state, highs 37 to 55 degrees. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Ed Morin.
This Day in Maine is made possible by Modern Pest Services, committed to taking an intelligent approach to pest control. Learn more at modernpest.com. And by the Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland. DempseyCenter.org.
On the next Maine Calling, the pandemic and substance use disorder. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Struggling with substance use is challenging enough during so-called normal times. Now there's the added strain of social isolation and difficulty accessing help in the middle of the COVID-19 crisis. Experts share how to support those in Maine with substance use disorder. Maine Calling, live at 1, rebroadcast at 7 on Maine Public Radio.
Many Maine communities have pared back or dropped recycling programs in an effort to guard workers from potential exposure to the COVID-19 virus. Some big supermarkets have also curtailed in-store redemption efforts. And to accommodate the moves, Governor Janet Mills has ordered that the state ease enforcement of some recycling rules. Fred Bever reports.
Last month, the New England Journal of Medicine published research demonstrating that the COVID-19 virus could persist on some metal and plastic surfaces for as long as 3 days, and a day or so on cardboard. That got noticed in solid waste and recycling circles.
People did want to put their workers at risk to handle the public's goods.
Victor Horton is the executive director of the Maine Resource Recovery Association, which acts as an advisor and broker for Maine municipalities looking to dispose of waste and recyclables.
Because you can't tell who's coming in that might have the virus or might be in the early stages or late or not. So they said, look, we can't take the risk to have all our people getting sick because, you know, sometimes when you're sick, you die.
Municipalities large and small moved to limit worker exposure by suspending recycling programs and encouraging residents to throw everything together in one bag. A collaborative of towns in the Unity area put its on indefinite hiatus, and many small towns took action on their own.
We have stopped receiving them. We're putting them in with our household garbage.
Thomas Brophy manages Stonington's transfer station.
And we closed down temporarily until everything gets straightened out here. We've also closed down our take it or leave it. You know, I tell people if you want to keep saving it at home, that'd be fine. And when we do open it back up, we'll gladly take it. But as of right now, if you need to get rid of it, it's got to go in the hopper.
Governor Janet Mills has issued an executive order designed to encourage public and worker safety in waste handling programs. Among other things, it allows recyclables to be burned at waste-to-energy plants and still count that towards the state's goal of 50% recycling. Dave Burns, who directs the state's waste management programs, says the goal is not so much to encourage incineration, but to discourage towns with suspended recycling programs from sending the added material to landfills.
Landfilling is the lowest alternative on the state's solid waste management hierarchy.
Burns was not able to provide data documenting how much recyclable material is being diverted to incinerators or landfills right now. Although you can't see inside most garbage bags, some in the industry do not believe much more recyclable material is being burned than before.
When it comes to recyclables, we're seeing an increase in recycling, especially on the residential front.
Matt Grondin is spokesman for Eco Maine. That's a Portland recycling center and trash-to-energy incinerator. He says that most of Eco Maine's member towns are continuing curbside pickup of unsorted recyclables. And while the stalled business sector is producing less waste and fewer recyclables than usual, Grondin says households are making up the difference.
As people are at home as opposed to their workplace, they're spending more of their time making waste at home. So we do see the increase on the residential side, both in trash and in recycling.
At the same time, the pandemic is creating some new profit opportunities in the recyclable markets. Recycled fiber, which in February was worth less than $50 a ton, has risen as high as $84 a ton. That's being driven by surging demand for retail shipping materials, for paper towels, and, of course, for toilet paper. Materials broker Victor Horton says some towns are leaving money on the table, albeit for understandable reasons.
And it's just unfortunate that a lot of the towns aren't going to be able to capitalize on it because they decided for safety reasons it's better to just throw the stuff in the garbage.
His hometown has suspended recycling, so for the moment, Horton is storing his own cardboard and cans in the garage. He's concerned, though, that some people's recycling habits may wither.
Once we train people to throw this away, how the heck are we going to train them to start being good again when it's safe to come out of our little holes and do it the way we used to do it? I'm hoping we can. It might take some more education.
It's worrying some environmentalists as well.
You know, from an advocacy standpoint, we immediately had to pivot from offense to defense.
Sarah Nichols is the Sustainable Maine Director at the Natural Resources Council of Maine. She says counting the incineration of materials towards recycling goals sends a bad message.
People are confused about what they can recycle even more than they already were. And one of my biggest concerns is actually with the bottle bill. The state has decided not to enforce our bottle bill collection, and it's resulting in less material going through that system.
State officials point out that many redemption centers remain open and are doing strong business. But Nichols says that nationally, the supply of clean glass, tin, and PET plastic is dropping. That may encourage container manufacturers to bypass recycled materials, she says, and instead forge new products using fossil fuels, which are now very inexpensive, courtesy of the pandemic. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The coronavirus has thrust us all into a new situation that can be disorienting. That's especially true for doctors and nurses who are treating patients with an illness they've never seen before. On Tuesday, the Mills administration launched a new statewide telephone line to support frontline workers. But there are also local efforts underway, including a new online peer support group at Maine Medical Center. Patty White reports.
Healthcare workers don't typically line up to expose their vulnerabilities, especially the emotional kind. you know, we have the kind of mentality of, well, we'll just get through this because that's what we need to do.
But COVID-19 is testing that, says Dr. Christine Hine. She's the associate medical director of the emergency department at Maine Medical Center and the chief wellness officer.
Medicine is a lot about pattern recognition, and we don't have that pattern here. So I would maybe compare it to, you know, flying an airplane without the instrument panel and without any vision.
Which creates a lot of new stresses for healthcare workers, often rooted in a fear of the unknown.
There's the fear of bringing this home to your family. Nobody understands exactly how this is spread. I mean, we obviously know that it's spread by contact and droplet, but the risk of airborne transmission and how long it can survive on different materials becomes a really front and center concern for people who are kind of working in that environment all day long and then go home to their children or their partners.
This is, of course, a situation that healthcare workers across the country are dealing with. And because Maine so far has been spared a surge of COVID-19 cases, doctors like Hine are able to learn from their counterparts in other states that have become hotspots. And Hine says one takeaway is clear.
That emotional support was something that was going to help sustain the ability to provide high quality care throughout this.
Maine Medical Center already has a peer support program to provide emotional first aid to doctors and nurses dealing with difficult situations. But now that staff are facing a pandemic, Hine says she and others realized that the hospital needed to provide regular check-ins dedicated solely to issues around COVID-19. So they started a weekly peer support group online. It's been going for about a month and typically draws between 1 to 2 dozen staff each meeting.
I was sort of surprised at how useful I found the experience myself.
Dr. Casey McVain works in the emergency department at the hospital.
One of the things that came up in one of the first meetings that I was really helpful was this idea of sort of anticipatory grief and this idea of not knowing what's coming, but feeling nervous about what's to come and feeling sad about what's to come. And that's been a lot of it.
Some of that nervousness of what's to come has already played out in smaller ways. McVain remembers showing up for work the day after Maine recorded its first confirmed case of COVID-19. Over the course of her shift, she learned there were several patients with COVID-19 at the hospital. People were showing up in the emergency department with respiratory symptoms. Policies and protocols changed rapidly, and McVain had to put on what's called a PAPR suit for the first time. It's a full protective suit with a gown, hood, and breathing apparatus.
And you can't hear very well, and you can't use a stethoscope, and you don't really have peripheral vision, and it's a little harder to move around and do things. So it just feels very different.
Nurses helped McVain get ready as a patient waited in a special room that contains contagious diseases.
Just feeling sort of that anxiety building as I had a sick patient in the room and I had to put everything on and go in there. And initially it felt like I wasn't sure what to do. And I realized I couldn't bring a stethoscope with me and I didn't know how I was going to listen to the patient. And the patient looked terrified.
Once she entered the room, she got her bearings. Performing her job in a protective suit may now feel less daunting, but McVain says other things remain difficult, like visitor restrictions. Patients enter and stay in the hospital alone.
We know how hard that is for our patients, and it's hard to be the bearer of that news and to watch our patients, you know, wish that their families could be with them.
When she meets with her peers online and hears about their experiences across different departments, McVain says she's able to recognize and then drop some of the own stress she carries.
I think if you pretend those things aren't there, sometimes it comes up in other ways. And I think it's okay to experience the grief or the anxiety or the frustration or whatever it is. And I think allowing yourself to actually feel it allows you to be more productive and then move on with the rest of your life.
Dr. Hine, who helped launch the peer support program, says the meetings are especially helpful during a time when connecting with others is a challenge due to social distancing.
The mere fact of seeing my dear colleagues' faces and hearing their experiences, which really pretty closely mirror my own experiences and my own emotions of caring for patients with COVID, it was very reassuring and almost centering to understand that everybody is feeling the same way.
Including a lingering question, say both Hine and McVain, of how bad things could get. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Knocking on doors and meeting personally with voters has long been crucial to political campaigns in Maine. Voters often like to talk to those who want to represent them in the legislature or in Congress. But as Mal Leary reports, the coronavirus pandemic has changed how candidates campaign.
Shaking hands at a restaurant, going to small gatherings in people's homes to discuss why they should be elected, and going door to door, dropping off literature and making personal connections, all are off the table for candidates as people self-isolate in their homes and as gatherings of more than 10 people are banned to reduce the spread of the virus.
With a husband, children, a dog, and a cat, and the dog is feisty tonight, so if there's noise in the background, I hope you'll forgive me.
That's Sarah Gideon, a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate, as she started a virtual town meeting using Zoom and Facebook. She says since the new coronavirus hit, virtual town meetings have replaced her suppers with Sarah as a principal way to reach voters in a format where they can interact with her.
It helps us feel a little more connected and also, you know, help people feel that I'm more on the spot as I'm answering them too, which I think is an important piece of being a candidate.
The internet town meeting has become a favorite of all the major candidates this year, including Betsy Sweet, who is also seeking the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate.
We are doing a thing where every day I am live on Facebook for 30 minutes. We change the time of day so different people can get on, but so people can listen. We bring up issues that are happening.
And it's not just Democrats that are using online technologies and other strategies to reach voters. Eric Brakey, a candidate for the Republican nomination in the 2nd Congressional District, says his campaign workers have shifted from going door to door to making phone calls.
You know, before the epidemic, it was certainly a lot easier. We were doing a lot of big town halls, and our team had knocked on over 35,000 doors across the 2nd District. But now our grassroots supporters are focused on our phone from home program.
Instead of traditional phone banks where dozens of campaign workers call voters, Brakey has supporters making calls from their homes to potential voters. Dale Crafts, also seeking the Republican nomination, says his campaign is also holding virtual town meetings and using other techniques to reach potential voters.
What we're doing a lot of is we're reaching out and I'm making a lot of phone calls. We're doing a lot of social media stuff, you know, videos, different stuff, and just pushing real hard.
And Kraft says another way the coronavirus has changed campaigns is that fundraising is now even more difficult. He says contributors who used to be willing to give the maximum amount under campaign finance laws have given a lot less because of the economic uncertainty caused by the virus. Adrian Bennett, the 3rd Republican seeking the nomination in the 2nd District, says she's been using mass emails, web advertising, and other social media from the start of her campaign.
Digital has changed the face of politics over the past few years, and whoever has been on top of it is going to come out faring a bit better.
All the candidates say they hope restrictions put in place to control the spread of the virus will ease by the fall. They still long for some old-fashioned rallies before they wind up their campaigns. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1, which looks at substance use disorder and the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Ed Morin.